momentarily thought, well, what if we went 200 years beyond Captain Picard's time? But then you're like, well, what does that mean? Like, you know, are the uniforms tighter? You know, are the phasers smaller?
I think you learned your lesson on the Voyager cast. Sorry, but, Voyager. Gonna go and do my convention thing. Got my costume, I'm going now. Yeah, we're having a ball. It's Star Trek, y'all. Hey, there's a border. Beam me up.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Shuttle Pod Show. Today, we have very special guest, Brannon Braga. We'll be answering some more of your fan questions, doing some Star Trek trivia, and much more. I'm Erica LaRose, and now for our hosts, Connor Trenier and Dominic Keating.
Erica, hi, how are you?
Hi, guys.
Yeah. Hi, my dear.
Yeah, we seem to have Wash remaining alive. Wash was in your care.
It Wash it? Stayed at my house. Yeah. Wash is the avocado tree. Yeah, Erica had to go out of town for a few days, so Wash stayed at my house and made some friends.
And, Dominic,
yeah. Oh, there are three little Washes now sitting by the window.
Are there?
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, Treks and Trekkers, we are honored to have in the Shuttle Pod today the co-creator of Enterprise, Brannon Braga, the man behind many shows, movies, and we'll find out shortly what he's doing.
Umpteen TV shows, indeed.
That's right.
Yeah, what are you up to these days, mate? It's good to see you, by the way. It's been a little long time. It really has.
It's been a long time. Yeah.
It's been Vegas was the last time. It was a few
really?
Years ago, yeah.
Wow.
We were all sort of stretched out of that one.
Right. Well, I think...
Anyway, so what are you... I mean, professionally speaking, what are you up to these days, mate?
You know, I'm making a show... Another Star Trek-ish show called The Orville.
Oh, yes, still on, yeah.
And season 3 comes out in a month.
It's been a little while, so there was a period of time where, what happened? Is that pandemic stopped it for a minute?
We shot about half the season and then pandemic, and then we came back and it slowed down, you know, filming slowed down to a crawl during the pandemic.
Right. Right.
Everything just took 10 times as long.
Right.
So,
where'd you shoot that?
On the Fox lot, or formerly known as the Fox lot.
Right, yeah. Right,
and so that comes out next month. And then I have a science adventure show called The End is Nigh with Bill Nye. And that's about the first half hour is the end of some end of the world scenario. And then the second half hour is how science can save us.
It's kind of love Bill Nye. Isn't he great? Is he a lovely man?
Yeah.
Can you say that?
No, he is.
I do love listening to him.
Aren't he and Bob Picardo like best friends?
They're best friends, yeah.
Yeah. Are they?
Yeah. Lovers, according to TMZ. Yeah. But,
and the National Enquirer.
Interstellar lovers.
But no, they're best. They're good buddies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to go back in time a little bit and ask about you as a writer. We've known each other a long time now. But there's a couple of questions I know I've never asked you. Much like I'd ask another actor, how old were you when you knew you wanted to be a writer?
I like your mirror universe look, by the way.
Oh, thank you. it's considered.
How old was I when I wanted?
Yeah, you grew up in Ohio, didn't you?
No, I grew up in Venice, California, and then puberty in Ohio.
In Ohio, yeah. Oh, right.
I wanted to be a filmmaker, but I didn't. You know. How do you do it? I didn't have camera, didn't have the knowledge.
Yeah, things are different
writing,
now.
But writing was free. And,
right.
And I always enjoyed writing.
And so eight, 9, 10 years old, you were like, did you pen stuff as early as that?
Yeah.
What sort of things? I mean, little short stories and...
You know, it was, I was mimicking a lot of things.
Right.
Like National Lampoon.
Right.
So I'd write funny stories in that vein, horror. I'd see John Carpenter's Halloween, and of course, the next 10 stories I wrote were just that.
Right.
You know.
Right.
Just kind of learning and adopting different styles, and you know, as a young writer.
So then you came back to go to. You did a writing program, didn't you, at Santa Cruz? Is that right?
No, I went to UC Santa Cruz.
Banana Slugs.
Right. Did not graduate. Dropped out of the astronomy course, ironically enough, couldn't finish. Too hard.
It got too difficult.
Isn't that nuts? You actually did the astronomy course and bottomed out.
Yeah, it was.
And then
it
made a fortune.
It was the math.
Yeah.
Right.
But I got an internship with the Academy of TV Arts and Sciences, which is a really great internship, still going. And I wanted to be a movie writer and director. You know, TV was, at that time, was a different thing. TV was a lot of crap.
Right.
And a few good...
I loved Canon.
Well, I did. So TV was not, you know, it was a TV writing internship.
No, absolutely
but
right.
But as luck would have it, ended up on Next Generation.
Yeah, how did you arrive at Paramount? What was that story? My understanding was that you went there as an intern?
I was an intern.
Yeah, no kidding.
Through that program.
No kidding. And, isn't that amazing?
And then...
And you never left. You wrote a script that did Rick notice you? Did Michael Piller notice you? What was that sort of?
Michael Piller was I would consider him my mentor. But then Rick would become my mentor. And you guys didn't work with Jerry Taylor, but
That's the name we were struggling for when we were having a coffee this morning before coming in, and we were sort of just outlining how this might go. Yeah, right.
But when people, you know, every success story is different, except in one regard, which is. You don't succeed alone. It always takes someone, a person or multiple people taking an interest in you.
Absolutely.
And helping you along. And that's what happened with me.
Here's to all those people that helped mentor us along the way. Yeah, we've done a couple of episodes talking about our stories to get to here, as it were. And there's either a master at school or a mistress or
somebody.
Somebody that says, you might,
But I believe in you.
Sees the flame. I believe.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That gives you that positive energy to keep moving forward and I don't know, make mistakes and hopefully have a door or two open.
That's right.
Did you cultivate Star Trek? Were you a fan of it?
I was aware of it. I liked the movies, but I never was a fan.
Right.
And a Next Generation at that time was my internship started the day after an episode called The Best of Both Worlds aired, which was a kind of a turning point for that show in terms of its quality and popularity.
Was it around season four-ish, five, four and a bit?
It was the end of season three.
Oh, right. Okay.
And I lucked out. The writing staff had all left for various reasons or been fired, I'm not sure. And it was Michael Piller and Ron Moore were the only writers there.
Right.
So I benefited from a vacuum as well,
Right. So... You guys need some help?
Yeah.
Do you remember the first script you wrote that got aired?
Yeah, it's called Reunion. It was a Worf Klingon episode.
Right.
His girlfriend gets murdered, and he finds out he has a son. And that was it was a rewrite. That was the first one.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
1990.
Well, did you just walk in because there was a vacuum, or did you give a spec script? How did they find you as a writer?
The internship program has a whole application process that I had to go through.
Right.
Didn't get it the first time the previous year, but reapplied. And they placed me with Michael Piller, who had agreed to be a mentor in the program for the screenwriting department.
For the Guild?
This was the Academy of TV Arts and Sciences. Oh, okay. They put on the Emmys every year.
Right.
And he chose me for whatever reason. You'd have to ask, he's dead now.
Yeah, so God bless him, rest his soul. Yeah.
Can't ask him. But I was lucky. It was the right place, the right time. But, when my internship ended, I got that assignment. It's an 8-week internship. I did a pretty good job. And, but Michael wasn't ready to hire me on staff. And it was Jerry Taylor who had come aboard during my internship, who persuaded him to take a gamble on me. So,
God bless.
And then 17 years later, or 15 years later, I was still there.
Did you know you had a facility for writing science fiction in general, or was it just characters that happened to be in space?
Star Trek was intimidating because I wasn't aware of the history of it. but I looked at it as an anthological show. Mm. If you look at a show like Next Generation, every episode's different. Sometimes it's a romance, sometimes it's time travel, sometimes it's horror. And I just embraced that, and I liked, I thought that we could experiment with narratives and tell stories in different ways. And my episodes tended to be very high concept, but empty calories. Not a lot of depth.
Looking great.
But cool.
Right, right.
It was a good fit for me.
Yeah, good fit. Because you have that kind of science-oriented brain, I think, and it's something you're interested in, isn't it, personally? I
mean, science,
in general.
Even though I couldn't. Yeah.
Even though the math wasn't there.
The math was never there.
But the exploratory nature and the wonder of it all, I think, I've always seen that about.
So, yeah, science, about you. I did come in with a strong interest in science and a lot of knowledge about quantum physics in particular, which had not really been exploited by, multiverses.
No.
They're very common, that's the thing now. Right. At that time, it was kind of...
No, Hawking's short history had not yet been published, maybe not yet. It was about to be, wasn't it?
It was being published.
But it certainly wasn't common fare on the bookshelf just yet.
No.
No, that was certainly an explosive moment.
Yeah. So you then write in the room. You're a member of the writing team.
I'm the intern.
You're still the intern. When did that end? I mean, you had the 8-week thing.
It's 8 weeks thing. Then I started as a staff writer. And made it to a story editor. This is all meaningless. They're just titles and pay bumps.
Mm-hmm.
And then I became a co-producer, whatever that means. And eventually moved on to Voyager and ended up running Voyager in its third season on. And
Was that under Pillar / Rick
It was not something I aspired to.
Right.
I was just happy to not have been fired yet. I always figured I was one bad script away. Still feel that way. But
it's a good feeling.
Well, it never goes away.
It never goes away. It really doesn't.
But
How did you like the directing bit? Because that was your first time on the Cosmos, wasn't it? How did you take to that?
I loved it. I always wanted to be a director, and I probably should have.
Why didn't you do our show?
Because I was writing the
show. Too busy writing.
For the modern younger audiences, back then we did when I started on Star Trek, 26 episodes a season.
Yeah, crazy.
In the same amount of time that people take to make
10, eight. Yeah,
right.
Crazy.
And on our show, we did 20.
We did 26 the first 2 years, and 20, then 22 right. and 22,
so when,
I think.
So when you're
like that.
Doing 26 episodes, and you're cranking out a script a week.
That's nuts, man.
You get 2 weeks off.
Yeah.
I got 2 weeks. I mean, that was my vacation, was 2 weeks, and then right back to the next season. I didn't have time to do much else.
No, right.
I mean, you didn't see me on the set all that often.
If ever, after the initial get-go for the pilot.
The pilot, was there, but I would come down if there was an issue.
Yes.
Other than that, I mean, we were writing for our lives.
Yeah.
You were able to crank out Mission Impossible 2, weren't you, during that time? Or was that?
That was before. Yeah, that was.
I'd forgotten your Mission Impossible moonlighting moment. Yes, indeed.
But I think that was before, though. That was in the 90s.
Was it?
Oh, no, wait. It was.
No, I think
no,
it was.
No, it was there.
It was 2000. Mission Impossible 2 was during. Were you involved in one Mission Impossible?
No.
So 2 was definitely during our moment there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I totally remember that.
I found time for that, I guess.
You didn't take 2 weeks off, did you?
Time for Tom. Yeah. Everyone's got time for Tom. So, let's talk about the pressure of, God, that episodic life, man. I don't know how you did it, mate. I mean, how many shows do you think you wrote for Star Trek overall? Is it 1,000?
No. I mean, I'm credited
hundreds
with,
and hundreds.
I mean, writing credit wise, somewhere in the neighborhood of 130.
Right.
But I also oversaw. I don't know how many I rewrote. I mean, it maybe is 300. I don't know.
What is that variation of a theme like, mate? I mean,
Well, you guys know, you were actors on the show.
Yeah.
By the way, you worked longer hours than I did, I think, at the end of the day.
He did. He especially did.
But, you know, what's it like having to memorize that and prepare for scenes as an actor, knowing the very next day you've got more and more and more?
Yeah.
Like it's really no different. It's just nonstop. You get in a groove. You know it has to be done. It has to get done.
Yeah.
You know, the worst case scenario for me was always, as a showrunner, shutting down production because I didn't have a script. Or a script was so bad.
How rare was that then? Never happened.
No, not under my watch.
Oh, bless you,
man. Well, I remember we would get a point near the end of
professional
writing.
Not the
first season, but maybe 2, 3, and 4 that, you know, in the last, I don't know, quarter of them, you'd be getting 2/3 of a script.
I never, the show never shut down, but I was rewriting scripts during prep. And yeah, you would get pages sometimes.
Yeah, literally.
What are these?
Yeah. The morning of. Yeah. No kidding.
But we didn't shut down, though.
No, we didn't
shut down.
Maybe we
should have. But yeah, no, it's just.
I know what you're saying. I mean, there's a couple of times I drove away at, you know, 6:35 on a Saturday morning, having shot a 3-page scene that started at, you know, 10 to 2.
Which, by the way, and maybe it was that scene you were really looking forward to.
Yeah.
And then it got scheduled at everyone's exhausted and just.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. We're going to push you to the end of the day.
You're going to that is, you know, there were a couple of times. I went home with a smile on my face, though. Like, you know, that's well done. Well done, kid. You know, that you brung it.
Yeah.
And I'm sure you feel this. And there's a skill set that I'm just not familiar with. Sitting down in front of a blank page scares the living bejesus out of me. The idea. When you put that first on the page, do you just bang one out and then rewrite it? Is that the way to go? Or do you
mean like coming up with story first and then fleshing that
out? Who says what first? Who says something first?
Well, you know, you have
a what scene?
You need a concept.
Right.
And the concept is developed into a story. And I was very detailed in the way I would break out the story scene by scene.
Mm.
So that a writer would have a highly detailed roadmap, because we didn't have a lot of time for experimentation. And nor did we when we were shooting. Sometimes scripts would be going under rewrites while we were shooting.
Right.
But once you had the pages, you had to say the words the way they were, because then you're in your arena where there was no time to screw around.
Right.
You know, you had a certain amount of time each day to get a certain amount of material filmed. And it's no different for me. I had to write a minimum of 5 pages a day.
Right.
A minimum. I had to write at least that much. I knew to, you know, if a script was 50 pages, well, do the math. That's 10 days. So I get a script. Oh, crap, this needs a page one rewrite. This isn't working. I have 10 days.
Right.
Minimum that I know I can get it done. So how does it begin? Fortunately, we did a lot of talking about stories and breaking them out scene by scene, so that when you sit down, at least you know.
Got a roadmap.
Here's what's supposed to happen in this scene, and here's where it takes place.
Right.
And so without that, you'd be doomed.
Yeah. Right. I see. So yeah, you've got a blueprint. You've got some sort of template, an outline.
And would you have to, or hopefully, with your only 2 weeks off, we would have a couple of months. You know, how many would you want to have in the bank once you got a season going?
Oh, man.
As many as you could.
I often fantasize how many fingers on my hand would I give away to have those 26 scripts
just mapped
delivered. And I think a couple fingers. I mean, I was at that point. Like, I was maybe the whole hand.
I mean, I don't really need the pinkies.
Just not these two. do you type well, by the way? Can you fully type, or are you a two-finger typer? You're a
thumb and three, maybe.
Thumb and three.
But
not amazing.
We tried to bank as many as possible, but our lead time up to a season, I think we had, I want to say we had 8 to 10 weeks. To figure out what we were going to do and break stories and get scripts written. We would probably go into a season, ideally, with 3 or 4 scripts.
Right, sort of set.
And then those got gobbled up immediately.
Sure.
Right.
And then you were right up against it, you know?
Talking of bringing on writers, so how did Manny arrive? Because that was obviously a big moment, yeah.
Finding writers. So in the first season, I think we had 10 writers on staff, and we were just trying people out. I think a lot of them didn't last.
Mm.
Chris Black did.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of good writers who aren't necessarily good Star Trek writers for the right reasons. And Manny was really the big find in season two?
Season three he came on.
Season three.
Yeah, I do remember reading his script going, that's quite good.
Yeah.
And coming to the front as, who is Manny Coto? So how did he arrive? What's that story? Do you remember the ins and outs of it?
I had read a pilot he wrote that was a series. I can't remember the name. It was a science fiction show with Peter Weller for one of the cable networks. I can't remember the name of it, but it was just a really good script. I remembered his name from a movie he directed called Dr. Giggles.
He directed Dr. Giggles.
And I think he wrote and directed Dr. Giggles.
Uh-huh.
And I remembered his name because back in the early 90s, movie spec scripts were kind of all the rage. And he, with Brian Helgeland, who's now a big director.
Right, yeah.
They wrote a spec script that I remember, it was in the trades. It sold for $1 million. It was called The Ticking Man.
Right.
And there was a bidding war for it. And
still that kind of money for those independent.
Yeah.
You know,
It was going to be a big film for Bruce Willis or Sylvester Stallone.
The Ticking Man.
But it never. And I just remember, and I thought it was a great script. So I met with him, and he was a Star Trek fan.
Yes,
longtime Star Trek fan.
Yeah,
and
it's like childhood fan, wasn't he?
And
yeah.
It, you know, sometimes you get. I mean, the dream come true is a writer who turns a draft in and. You just don't have to do anything.
Right.
It's great.
It's like I've got the weekend off.
Well, it's just that's what, and Manny just got the show. He nailed it. And the biggest dream is he was writing it better than I was. And that's what you're really looking for.
Well, I don't do yourself a disservice, mate. I mean, you got to think about that too, B. You wrote that show for at least 15 years straight. I mean, you must have been,
Manny was a little fresher, I think.
Yeah, of course. I mean, and this was a big step up for him when he, certainly by the time, you know, you handed him the reins, as it were, and went, okay, the pony's yours. I'll look in and, you know, I'm there for you. But, you know, this was a big step up for Manny. And he, God knows, he took it with both hands, didn't he? And the rest is history. He's gone on to be a huge talent in town. Yeah.
I want to know. What was the seed that was planted for Enterprise? Was that a plan? Did you know what show was going to be the next one after Voyager? How did that come about?
Did you ask Rick this question?
Nope.
No, I don't think we did.
Why would you not ask Rick this question?
Because I was saving it for you.
we saved. There's a couple of questions I've yet to ask.
Well, it was actually again this. I was immersed in Voyager at the time, and Rick called to see if I wanted to create the next show with him. It was not something I expected or was even thinking about.
No kidding.
Yeah. And
we would never have thought that wasn't a natural progression that you
would
have
just... Well, it was in that we had developed a close relationship. We were friends. We're really aligned creatively,
right?
And so it felt natural, but I didn't know that there was another one being planned,
right?
And I knew Rick had wanted to wait. He didn't want another. You know, he was trying to convince the Paramount executives to not put another one on right after Voyager, to wait.
He did mention that he thought maybe there needed to be some sort of downtime.
Yeah, yeah. And they disagreed.
Yeah,
and he actually had the initial idea for the show, which was
to do a prequel,
right? They're still making prequels in the Star Trek world, which is surprising to me.
Yeah, the New Worlds.
New Worlds.
Yeah,
it's like Discovery and New Worlds are both prequels. I guess they're
prequels.
Well, they're between Enterprise and
yes, they're in that timeline there. Yeah. 200 years or something, isn't it, in between us and the original series?
But it was we needed something that a little bit different. You know, we wanted to do something a little more contemporary, characters that are a little closer to you, to people today.
Mm.
People who might be terrified of using the transporter.
Fruits and vegetables only. I remember that was one of my audition scenes.
And it's seemed like a great idea.
Mm.
And
I thought it was.
And we started talking about it. It was, you know, it evolved. It was initially going to be, in our initial discussions, a show that took place on Earth. And the launch of the Enterprise was going to happen sometime in the first season, if not at the end. It was going to be a little more.
Oh, so it was going to be more earthbound, as it were.
At first.
Right, right.
At first.
Interesting.
And by the way, these are just differences of opinion, and I may be misremembering, so this comes with a disclaimer.
Right.
But I remember the Paramount executives hated the idea.
I can imagine. Well, I was going to say, you're going to make a space show without being in space.
They hated the prequel. They wanted us to stay in the future. And it's like, well, this is the future.
Right, ladies and gentlemen.
And they said, why don't you go further in the future?
Was that Kerry McCluggage?
It was them. And by the way, supporters.
And
really friends of Star Trek and kept the helped keep the franchise going for so long. But so we momentarily thought, well, what if we went 200 years beyond Captain Picard's time? But then you're like, well, what does that mean? Like, you know, are the uniforms tighter? You know, are the phasers smaller?
I think you learned your lesson on the Voyager cast. Sorry, Voyager.
But anyway, it's it took some convincing.
Uh-huh.
And that's where this for people who know the show, there was this subplot involving something called a temporal Cold War.
Right.
I know that was a fan question. Should we get into that? Yeah, because I mean, it was quite avant-garde at the time, that storyline, wasn't it?
It was an idea for, I wanted to do a whole show about the temporal Cold War, a separate show.
Right.
And because I thought it was a cool idea that there were these, that some kind of disaster occurred involving time travel and all the nations of the world agreed to ban it. But they started sending these Cold War, post-time travel Cold War agents to different periods in time. So it'd be a show set. It's still a good idea.
That's a great idea.
Is this just an original thing, a concept out of Brandon Braga's head?
Yes.
Yeah, God bless me.
But I said to Rick, maybe they'll go for the prequel. Because at that point, they didn't want to do a prequel. If we put this element into it, which is a far-flung, futuristic, high-concept element.
Yeah.
And they went for it.
Yeah.
And that's how that...
Hey, look over here.
Yes, I know, it was bait and switch.
Initially, I thought it was pretty cool. It became nightmarish to service because it was overly complicated. And it actually, in retrospect, I wished I had saved it for its own show because I think it clouded Enterprise, you know.
And the temporal Cold War, was it given up on?
No. Well, I can't speak for season four, but
it's wound up at the end.
I didn't give up on it. It was just becoming unclear how to sustain it in an interesting way, you know. And every time I would have to write an episode involving it, it was hard.
Yeah.
You know, I think there's an episode called Cold Front in season one. And it was just I was like, this fun to write, fun to watch. That's always my motto. Mm-hmm. And I'm not having fun writing this. This is not going to be fun for the audience. Something's wrong with this concept being in this show. And so you didn't see a lot of the Temporal Cold War in Enterprise beyond the pilot.
It was
kind of a now and then kind of thing.
Right, right.
Did you feel like you'd painted yourself into a corner with it by the time?
No, I wasn't entirely sure where to take it, you know, or maybe I did. No, I'm forgetting. I don't know.
How was the experience different creating, executive producing, you know, sort of taking the step up the ladder than it had been, say, on Voyager, when you didn't expect to have Enterprise sort of put in front of you? Were you just wearing more and different hats?
No, it was similar. I mean, I was involved in the beginning of Voyager and some of the casting and all that stuff too. I mean, so I'd already kind of helped lay the groundwork for a show, but never to this detail. I wasn't involved in designing the ship. Enterprise was the first all CGI ship, for the record, which was really cool. And I was involved in everything.
Right.
On Enterprise. Yeah.
And would you have to be, touching base with different departments, the art department?
When you're making the show, I mean, I'm not just writing the show, I'm running production meetings.
Mm-hmm.
And the directors are visiting.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we had recurring directors, of course, but it was my job to approve every costume, every design, everything.
Right.
And in retrospect, I probably should have. Problem with directing is,
yeah,
I felt like I was kind of doing it all anyway.
Right.
I mean, the fun part.
Right.
You know,
right.
The filming, you know, as a director now.
Right.
My problem, I love directing, but you have to be there.
You've
got to
be
time.
Actually there.
You actually have to be
16 hours a day.
The first one to get there and last one to leave.
Yeah. Right.
And I'm like, it's more fun in the prep.
Yeah.
And as a showrunner, you're overseeing the prep.
I sort of know what you mean. I like getting the job. Now I've got to do it.
Yeah. It's less and less fun as you go further and further away from the actual
I also
show.
Wasn't, you know, I think some, I wasn't experienced directing actors. And I felt a little worried about that.
Right.
But now, not that you guys needed directing, because you knew the show better than any visiting director. But at the same time,
certainly within a few episodes of the once it was set.
It's always interesting when you're on set if you're either a guest actor or a regular, because again, you have these, you know, guest directors come in week after week, and usually if you got your lines right.
Yeah.
Okay. How do you feel about that?
Yeah. We're moving on.
Do you want to move on? Can I have another one? Absolutely.
Yeah.
And if you're a guest actor, you get two shots.
You get two shots.
Really?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. No, it was, I mean, honestly, it would be an absolute courtesy on behalf of the director / Marvin if I even said, and if it was a particularly, you know, good scene, good speech, something, they might let you, if you didn't get up and the camera was good. And back in the days when a hair in the gate mattered, it was like, really? Don?
If it was like an episode of yours, I always found like, you know, and in particular with LeVar, he'd be like, we got it. And I'd be like, can I have another one? He'd be like, yeah, but we got it. I'm like, I know, but wait. This is going to be great. And it was usually not.
Pile on the pressure. No, it never was.
Yeah, I mean, I've never acted in my life, but I had a cameo with no dialogue in The Last Cosmos, where I was playing a scientist.
In a white coat?
An old-time scientist.
Well, it's not right.
But all I had to do was walk from point A to point B and pretend that I was talking to another guy.
Did you trip?
And pretend that I was enjoying the conversation.
Right.
Okay, so now there's acting.
Pressure.
Sure. Now I have to look a certain, I got it, I did it, and I'm like, now that, I actually was enjoying it, it was great, and it was out of focus.
Right.
So you have to do it again.
And then I was like, this is why, no way would I ever want to be an actor.
Right,
imagine you felt, I'm sure you've had a situation where you feel like you just nailed
it.
And then there was a mistake.
And there's a hair in the gate. Or your
hair was flipped up or something.
Something technically not shiny. Right.
But that's what your professional actor has to deal with.
It sure as shit is, man.
Yeah.
No kidding.
It's all those different things going on at one time, and then you have to sort of find your way and your place to, I don't know, be free to tell that story and say those lines in a
decent
fashion.
Are you going to have Scott on?
We'd like to.
I kind of lost touch with him, to be honest.
You can write to NCIS New Orleans.
Yeah, that's all.
It's a shame.
But he's got a new one coming.
Oh, he does?
He's got another show.
Sort of Yellowstone-ish.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, playing a mountain man. I'd buy him as a mountain man.
Playing a sheriff or something.
He's extraordinary, isn't he? God bless him. Lovely bloke. How had the casting of Scott in it? Because I don't think Rick really, we didn't get into that with him. How did his name, was that a Kerry McCluggage relationship?
It was. And,
yeah. So they were they looking for something for him at Paramount at that time?
You'd have to ask Kerry, but Kerry brought his name up. And we were looking, when we were writing the character, we thought about Tom Skerritt as an archetype from The Right Stuff.
It would have been nice,
You know, Harrison Ford type.
Yes, that was the name. I said to Rick, God, when I saw that Scott's name was connected to this, I was like, whoa, if they didn't get Harrison Ford, you know, well, there you go. I really miss those days, man. I tell you, watching the show as I have done in the last few months, it's, God, the remembrances. And I just watched The Offer, which is the making of The Godfather on Paramount Plus. And all the scenes at Paramount and the studio is highly, you know, front and center. And The Godfather Alley and all our times there were just like, wow.
What's your favorite studio? As a studio.
Oh, Paramount.
Yeah.
It's a great place, isn't it?
Yeah, they manicured it well. It has a nice back lot. Original buildings for the most part. It's big.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Fox, formerly known as Fox. What's
it called now?
It's still called
Staples
Fox
Center?
It's still being called the Fox lot, but it's smaller. It's not, it doesn't quite have the grandeur. It doesn't have that gate.
Right.
Right. Right.
Yeah. You know, those two gates that you see in Sunset Boulevard and Disney's kind of boring and Warner Brothers is not bad. I'm at Universal Studios now.
Right.
But that has that weird vibe of being a fake back lot.
Right.
You know, like I'll be at work and there's the trams are going by this isn't what it's really like.
Right. Or the Flintstones village of Hamblin or whatever it is.
Right. It's Paramount was always my favorite. No, I was there a lot. I was there on that lot for 17 years.
Amazing.
So I have a lot of really good memories there.
I was in the Hart building, wasn't it? You were the writer's room, wasn't it? Yeah. I was going to circle back to the writing. I mean, Star Trek in general, and I know on our show, I remember when Jan came up to me after I nailed one of the early speeches and she said, well, you got Ann and Arv wrong here. And did that preciousness?
Are you referring to the script supervisor?
Jan, our script supervisor. It has a notoriety for being quite, you know, on point about what you wrote. I mean, did that come from the writer's room? I mean, not to be too in your face about it, but it's something that people always ask about.
It's a great question. It is true that even the smallest change to an article was, would be called to an actor's attention.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Rick and I would sit and go over every line. His notes usually came in the form of, if there were no general story notes, refining dialogue. But we manicured the dialogue down to every word. And it was very handcrafted, and we took pride in it. And we expected you guys to say the words. And if you wanted to change something, great, no problem.
It required a call.
Just required a call. It's not a big deal. And of course, there's the time issue. I mean, you guys.
No, I'm so.
By the way, you're memorizing this dialogue as it is. You don't want some other actor to start changing the scene that you've prepared for. And we have a certain amount of time to shoot this stuff.
Yeah.
So I think it was a good system. But you were always welcome to call, and you were and. The problem was you didn't get the scripts in ahead of time because they weren't ready. I was always cognizant of when you would get scripts because I wanted to get them to you early enough to read and prepare for, but not too early.
That was a luxury for ShuttlePod 1, that you got that script to us at least a week, if not 10 days before we went to the first scene.
Yeah, we were able to rehearse it.
And we rehearsed it in my little flat in Beechwood, and we were word perfect by the time we got to set for that one.
The only times being word perfect was difficult for me was often, was when I didn't know my lines particularly well. And I remember saying, Jan would go, I know, but wasn't it close? it was close.
Not close enough.
We still got to make a call. And I was like, I don't know this. So yeah,
it was. I tell you one thing, the gymnasium that you described just now, it has held me in good stead, Brandon, and I can learn a 3-page scene in 25 minutes now, word perfect. And partly that was also Scott's coaching. He said, think of it like an acting gymnasium, Dom. Do what they asked, learn it word perfect and be prideful in it. And so I take your note and I take your point that you spent time crafting this stuff, and it wasn't a bit like Mammoth. It wasn't thrown together. Every pause, huff and puff was, you know, meted out.
And it's a muscle. It's a muscle.
And it is a muscle.
You know that you're,
and you either,
that's a requirement.
Yeah.
And you do it and you get better at doing it.
And you get better at doing it rather than this lackadaisical, you know, well, I kind of got it. Yeah, but it's not the same thing.
But you didn't get it.
Well, you didn't get it.
And sometimes on a show like Star Trek, this a changing of a word could change an entire storyline.
Right.
Like, especially if it was some kind of science fiction mystery going on. Or
right.
Like,
right.
The language could become very pivotal.
Yeah.
Right.
In the way things are said.
Right.
So, you know, it was just a policy that I inherited. It was already in place when I came aboard the
next. Was Michael Piller, really, and I think it was Ron Moore?
No, it was
William Roddenberry?
It had to have started with Gene.
Right.
Had to have.
Right.
And Rick took over the mantle.
Right.
And it was really, you know, Rick. And Rick was the one who would give super detailed dialogue notes.
Right. Like
we would sit and pencil in, changing little words here and there, but just to make it more concise, or more elegant, or more, or less stilted.
Yeah.
You know, so a lot of work went into every single script.
I love finding people who they would come to the show or who come to conventions and they do very important things in the world, be astronauts, scientists, or engineers, or whatever. And I really take a great deal of pride in that their inspiration for it has been Star Trek.
Our show.
It is. And I think, me too. I mean, sometimes I was at some convention in New York and a young woman who had just gotten her graduate degree in biology said, thank you for my childhood.
Yeah.
Isn't that something? I know it's humbling, isn't it?
It really is.
It really is.
But it also makes you.
Gives you worth.
You don't think of it at the, you just really think about it at the time.
No,
but Star Trek reaches a lot of people around the world and has an impact on people.
It's really.
And, but we took it very seriously. And that's why some scripts were howlingly bad. I think there were a couple real dogs. I was looking at the list of episodes.
there's a couple in the early, in the first season that are not brilliant.
But you never set out to make them bad. And you don't know that. And you did, sometimes you're like, well, that's, it was always story issues. It was never the way the characters talked. They always were the characters. And you guys, even in the most dicey of scripts, delivered or made them better.
Bless you. Thank you.
But there were, when you're doing 26 a season, even on, I don't care if it's Voyager or Next Generation, they're not all going to be.
How can they be? I don't know how they can.
The Muse is sometimes busy.
Yeah, but our show, I think, is looked. You know, there. First of all, it did really well when it came out. It got great reviews.
13.5 million for that pilot, I think, with the numbers.
Today, if you got those numbers today, you'd
lose your mind.
People would go berserk.
They'd give you the keys to everything.
And that was on a network with only partial coverage around the country.
Right?
But we also took a lot of flack because we were, I think we came out too soon.
You mean after Voyager? You mean?
Yeah. But I also think a lot of it, a lot of the criticism's deserved, but a lot of it's not deserved. And I think people look back fondly at the show.
We've noted that at the conventions in the last 15, certainly in the last 10 years.
It going on Netflix and then going on Paramount Plus and people's access to it. And quite frankly, the lockdown.
Mm. Yeah. You know, interesting. Without a doubt.
Interesting.
They, you know, were able to binge watch the show. And I always get annoyed when I hear that, you know, somebody walks up and said, yeah, I didn't watch it the first time.
I'll still take their money.
But exactly. But, you know, you're thinking, well, why? They watched all the other ones.
Because there was, people have their Star Trek, and believe me, there are people out there. Yeah. Enterprise was their show, their first exposure to it.
Yeah,
and they're gonna.
What do you think about that? Because I mean, I've been watching some of the original series again. I mean, some of it, the early stuff is kind of goofy.
Well, you got to put it in context.
I mean, it is in the '60s. I'll grant you. But, I mean,
are also amazingly great episodes.
Yeah.
But it was also,
you kind of get into it.
You've got to put it all in the context of the time.
Right.
What I do think that Gene did really well was he did timelessness well. Like there's just no, you know, there were certain things that you did without calling attention to it. You didn't use a lot of idiomatic phrasing that would, or slang.
Right.
Again, had to be written in a classical style. He did diversity well in that his vision was, of course, it's diverse.
Yeah.
And
I mean, there's the casting of it.
But very matter of fact, because that's the way the future will be.
Yeah. Right.
And I think it's an all-inclusive future and a really positive future. And that's, to me, when I'm asked, why is Star Trek still popular? I really feel that, aside from fundamentally good stories, it's the only science fiction show that has a positive outlook. Mm-hmm. I mean, most science fiction is about, you know, like
dystopia and
Hunger Games.
Yeah,
it's about some children murdering other children for food. Like it was popular. I didn't see the movies. I'm sure they were good. But that's not going to stand the test of time as beloved. I mean, could it be beloved?
Right.
Yeah, it sort of supersedes of its timeness, as it were. Yeah, something like that won't. You mustn't take it for granted that it was a multiracial cast in 1968, which was, you know.
The originals was so groundbreaking on so many levels, and they could tell stories, you know, exploring racial tensions is not something you could do on a regular show.
Right.
Like it was not, the networks would go for it. Yeah, like, but using science fiction metaphors, even if it is a guy painted half black, half white, and another guy playing it.
Just saw that episode,
it might seem silly by today's standards, but they were able to dig deep into themes that no one else could touch. And that's where the science fiction allegorical storytelling is so powerful, and another reason Star Trek's so popular.
Well, it frees you up to be able to do that very thing is to you know, couch it in science fiction, and so therefore, I mean, all doors are open.
Right.
Exactly. You can blow the lid off something if you want. I think that we have some fan questions. Would you like to hear some?
Hey, newsflash, it's Dominic here. We got some very exciting news to share with you. First of all, thank you so much for all your love and support for this show. We're super excited. And a lot of you have been writing in and letting us know that you want more. So with that in mind, we are going to launch our Patreon channel, where you'll get access to uncut episodes, a lot of bonus content, maybe my arse, and a whole lot more. So check out the link to Patreon below, and we'll keep the entertainment coming. Nanu, nanu.
I quit.